pleasant Lord's Day afternoon, and I'm so pleased to see everybody back out this evening. What better way to conclude the day as we prepare to go out into the battlefield for another week, and to get together with our brothers and sisters once again to draw strength from them as well as from the Word of God itself. We're going to continue this evening in a series of studies that have been kind of different for the last few weeks, and talk about why we believe that there is a God, that there is a Creator. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That is, of course, Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. The opening words of the Bible, and a pretty good summary of what the Bible believer believes with regard to how all things came into being. Although our belief in this regard is being challenged more vociferously, it seems, every day. Tonight we're going to continue our series of studies in which we have sought to make the case that, whatever you want to call it for that right now, make the case maybe that an intelligent designer, a creator, a God that has made all things is actually a more reasonable explanation for all that we see than any of the what we call naturalistic explanations for this, all of which promote the idea that everything we see around us came into being through a series of random happenstance events with no intelligence guiding it over billions of years. As I noted in our last session, that was 2 weeks ago, of course, that we have been throughout this series really just seeking to establish reasonable doubt with regard to such naturalistic explanations, showing, even through scientific realities, that such explanations are not reasonable. And of course, if you eliminate that as being reasonable, you are left with a creator as the only reasonable alternative left. I'll go ahead and let you know up front tonight that tonight's session is intended to be the penultimate session of these studies. We'll try to wrap this series up next Sunday night, the last Sunday of the year. But again, as we've been through this, we've looked at various questions that can be raised that will be answered by one of our two options: that it happened through random events, or it happened by design. We talked about the foundation of the universe and how it began and how it all came into being as an organized universe that behaves in a predictable way. Well, that either happened by design or it happened by chance. We talked about life, the beginning of life, and in particular, life on Earth, how that it began and how that it developed into what we see on our planet today. It either began by random events or it began by design. We've tried to be fair, and we've tried to carefully note the naturalistic explanation of such things. And we've seen now that at some point in the process, with regard to all of these questions, naturalistic explanations are found wanting. Personally, I suspect that this is because when it comes to explaining origins, science is really out of its lane. Because science is all about making observations and finding explanations for what is observed in the natural, material world at present. And so at each step along the way in our studies, we found that natural answers just don't add up so well to the questions we're asking. And this implies an explanation that is not natural or observable. Remember, Dr. Dotsenko from Russia said that the organizing force that holds the universe together cannot be material because it would become disorganized as well. So we're looking at something that is not natural, that is not material. And of course, we've taken note of what Jesus said in this regard regarding His Father in heaven. How that in John 4 and verse 24, Jesus noted, God is spirit. He is not material. He is not natural. And if the source of life, the universe, and everything is not natural or observable, science is never going to be able to explain it. Well, science is good, and science is has been helpful in so many ways. Science has done very well in helping us to understand things about the way the world works in the here and now. We've learned through the observation scientific observation, for example, that an object, any object, if you drop it, is going to drop at 32 feet per second squared. Well, that's useful information that we can make use of. We've been able, through science, to determine that light travels at 186,000 miles per second, that water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, and that chlorophyll is what makes the leaves and the grass green. And you know, there are evolutionists who believe and accept all these facts. And there are creationists who believe and accept all of these facts. Because what is actually observable as to how the universe works is not affected by what you believe about the origin of the universe and life that is in it. And the fact is, science can no more observe a universe coming into existence on its own than it can observe the events of Genesis 1. It's really good with regard to the things that it can observe, not so good with the things that it cannot observe. See, whether you're talking about creationism or these naturalistic explanations, neither can be proven scientifically. But remember what we've been saying, is that one of them can be eliminated scientifically as a reasonable alternative. And we can eliminate it using certain laws of science and physics that no reasonable person denies. And that's kind of what we've been doing through this series. What we've been trying to do with regard to the origins of everything. Last week we talked about the possibility that the evolutionary process, as promoted by Charles Darwin, could account and explain how the earth has come to have the great diversity of life that it has. And without going into the details of that last session, I'll note that based on what can be seen in the way life works on earth today, evolution is not workable as a means of providing an explanation. Based on observations and what we have learned about how life works on earth, it is not reasonable, not observable, and thus not observed. Evolution is not. But as we begin tonight, I want to acknowledge something. I want to acknowledge that there have been instances where something that on paper does not look like it should work has happened nevertheless. I've heard it said, for example, that aerodynamically speaking, a bumblebee should not be able to fly. But they do, don't they? I have observed that, and you have observed that many times. Well, tonight, we're going to pose the question, in order to be fair, is that can the evolutionist overcome the obstacle of what should not be workable, according to the laws of science, by pointing out somewhere when it actually has happened anyway? When we can document when one kind of animal changed into another kind of an animal, and it can be actually observed. In this case, after the fact. Nobody sees it happening now, but can we observe it after the fact? And I'll explain how we'll do that in just a minute. But regardless of whether it should work, and we've established that it shouldn't, has it happened anyway? Can such be shown? And think about this. You know, even one of our most foundational beliefs is something that shouldn't be able to happen. In all fairness, based on the way the world works, people don't return from the dead, do they? But we know that someone once did. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 6 says that over 500 people saw Jesus alive after he had been confirmed dead. And the question I want to ask tonight, and again, to be fair, can the same be said with regard to the gradual change from one kind of creature into another? Tonight, in the remainder of our time together, as I said, I want to see if we can see this happening after the fact. I want us to consider the fossil record. You see, since evolution is not observed or observable as it happens in the current world, if it happens, then the fossil record is really the most foundational evidence that evolutionists can point to, if they can point to that, as proof that whether we believe it is workable or not, it has happened at some point in the past. The idea being that as we uncover fossils of creatures that lived on Earth in earlier times, what those fossils show us about the development of life on Earth, the thinking is, will support the idea of Darwinian evolution. And we'll talk about what they're looking for in just a moment. But fossils are the only possible hard and fast evidence to which the evolutionists can turn to at this point to support their theory. If living things did develop the way that they say they did, there should be evidence in the record. If evolution cannot be seen in the fossil record, then there's really no way to prove it anywhere or any way. And Darwinists in general will admit this. So they've come up with a way of studying the fossil record very carefully and organizing all the layers of rock in the world called strata. And they've come up with what they call the standard geologic column. And what this is a representation of all the layers of rock to be found throughout the earth. They've looked at these different kinds of rock and what they believe to be different ages of rock, and they've organized them, they've arranged them in this column where the oldest are on the bottom and then the younger rock are laid on top. Now, all these rocks, all these layers of rock taken together would be about 100 to 200 miles thick. But we need to keep in mind, this column is theoretical. And by that I mean, there is nowhere on earth where you can go where you will find all of these layers of rocks together in one place. You're not going to find that 200 mile thick place where you find Quaternary, Tertiary, Cretaceous, Jurassic, right? There's no place where they're all at the same place on earth. In actuality, the average thickness of rock strata on earth is about 1 mile. But the idea is that every stratum listed in the column can be found somewhere. They're not all together in one place, but each one can be found somewhere on earth. And those who rely on this standard geologic column in their study of the origin of life believe that each layer of rock was laid down during a different geologic age, and each of these ages covered millions and billions of years. We've already talked a little bit about the problem with the dating of rocks, have we not? Some of the flaws in the assumptions that are made. But of course, millions of years is needed, so that's what they're assumed to be. Because remember, the idea behind evolution is, given enough time, anything is possible. Well, as I said, in previous studies, we've talked about the difficulties science has in determining the age of rocks by these radiometric dating methods. And we can see such difficulties in other ways as well. Now, first of all, before I show you what I'm going to show you next, be aware that according to evolutionists, modern man, Homo sapien, has only been around about 200,000 years. And what is believed to be the earliest predecessors to humans has been around about 2.5 million years. It's about as far back as you can go for something resembling humanity. And yet, a metal hammer with a wooden handle was excavated out of rock that was dated at 135 million years of age. Here again, that doesn't really work. It suggests that the rock is not as old as we are told that it is. That's a difficulty with their determining the age of the rock and how long man has been around. We can also note that there have been fossilized trees that have been discovered that extend through several different rock strata that are supposed to be separated by millions of years. Well, that's really not possible. And again, my point being that one of the assumptions of the standard geologic column is that the different strata represent the passage of millions and even billions of years, but things like this undermine the credibility of that assumption. But again, as we've done with some other things, let's go ahead for a moment and lay aside that inconvenient truth and simply focus on the notion of how the geologic column is supposed to show us how life has developed on Earth, no matter how long the process took. What are the expectations that evolutionists would have for what they find in the geologic column? Well, evolutionists expect two basic things to be true in the fossil record. One is that the oldest geologic layers must contain the earliest and most underdeveloped forms of life, or undeveloped forms of life, while the youngest layers, of course, hold the most developed and evolutionary complex organisms. And this is a very big and, amid these layers must exist transitional fossils or intermediate forms, proof that life evolved in a gradual, stepwise fashion from the most simple and undeveloped to the most complex organism. So they're expecting the oldest rock to be on the bottom and the most underdeveloped organisms to be in those lower levels of rock. And up here at the top, the most developed organisms like us. But also interspersed among all those layers of rocks, they say we've got to find transitional fossils. What's a transitional fossil? It's a fossil that shows an animal in the process of changing from one kind of animal into another kind of animal. That's what they need to find. That's what they will tell you they need to find. Now, for comparison's sake, let's take note of what creationism would expect from the geologic column. We should see sudden appearances of fully formed animals interspersed between the geologic layers. And I guess really the second thing is just kind of the flip side of that. No transitional or intermediate fossils between animal kinds should be found. For the creation is what we should expect to find in the geologic column is every time you see an animal, it's fully formed, fully developed. And you never once should find a transitional fossil. We'll get that up there now. But guess which one of these the fossil record most closely resembles. And consider that at the time of his observations and writing, Darwin was relying on discoveries not yet made to support his idea about evolution. We're living 150, 160 years after Charles Darwin, and they still haven't found these transitional fossils. At the time he was living, Darwin actually thought that the fossil record that they had at that time, now understand, and we understand they didn't have as much data then as we do now, but he said the fossil record that was available at his time, actually he considered to be evidence against his theory because there were no fossils that showed one kind of creature in the process of turning into another. There were no transitional fossils. It's just that Darwin predicted, well, give us enough time and we'll find those fossils. Again, with evolutionists, it's always about needing more time. Give us enough time and the geologic column will uncover this evidence and validate my hypothesis. Well, again, the year is now 2021. And though every stratum listed in the geologic column has been found somewhere on Earth and has been thoroughly examined, I mean, and by the way, that means there's nowhere else to look. Nowhere in any of these strata have fossils been shown that show a step-by-step change from one living kind of living creature to another. That shows a creature in the process of changing into a different kind of creature. To date, geologic finds have supported just the opposite of Darwin's theory. Fossils always appear in fully developed form rather than in transitional form, as though they were created fully developed. So what we've got is a case where in the 1800s, a man wrote about the evolution of all living creatures, and most scientists of that time began to accept his theory, despite there being no evidence to support it. It's just that, like Darwin himself, Most of those early evolutionists predicted, well, we will find that evidence eventually. We will find fossil evidence of gradual change from one kind of animal to another in bones or fossilized bodies found in the Earth's rocks. What they did was they developed a belief system. That's what it is. They developed a belief system based on what they predict. What they predicted, and I guess we still say what they predict, will be found in the future. A prediction that has not yet been fulfilled. In over 150 years since Darwin proposed his theory, millions of fossils have been uncovered with not one complete sequence in the entire fossil record of change from one kind of plant or animal to another. As a result, it's been said that there are more scientists who support the idea of the development of man from ape-like creatures than there are fossils to support it. There are what are called gaps in the fossil record. By the term gap, really all that means is there's a lack of those transitional fossils that we're talking about. A lack of fossils that show any creatures in the process of developing from one kind of animal into another. That would demonstrate gradual changes in animals that Darwinism proposes. And take note of what I'm saying here. And again, I'm not a professional scientist, but I love to read, and I have read a good bit. But I'm not saying here that there's not many such fossils. I'm saying there's not any that have been found. Those transitional fossils, the ones that would show transitional creatures, don't exist. None have been found. What you have in the fossil record is the sudden appearance of groups of plants and animals in the strata. This sudden appearance of kinds is strong evidence against the theory that supports gradual changes. And again, Darwin himself acknowledged the difficulties involved. He acknowledged that there are major groups of animals, what we now call phyla in the scientific terminology, that appear suddenly in the fossil record that contradict what his theory said should be found. More recently, there was a man by the name of Stephen Gould. He passed away a few years ago, but prior to his death, he was considered to be one of the more celebrated and renowned evolutionists of the 20th century. And yet, even Dr. Gould stated, most species exhibit no directional change during their tenure on Earth. They appear in the fossil record looking much the same as when they disappear. A species does not rise gradually by the steady transformation of its ancestors. It appears all at once and fully formed. Now, I read quotes like that from men like that, and I think, well, it's very honest of you to admit this. So why are you still an evolutionist? But of course, in his case, unfortunately, I don't believe he is an evolutionist anymore. Learning things the hard way, as it were. But you see, there is an explanation for life on Earth that does not contradict what is in the fossil record. For the creationist, the answer to the question of how life on Earth came about is found in the opening pages of the Bible, in what David read for us earlier of the creation account. Genesis 1 gives an account of the first 6 days in which God created all that there is and provides nothing that would contradict what we see in the earth. Day 1, beginning in verse 1, he brings the heavens and the earth into existence as well as light. And we might note that the Hebrew writer, and we've taken note of this earlier in these studies, the Hebrew writer tells us he did all this from nothing. He simply spoke these things into existence. Day 2, beginning in verse 6, God divides the waters on the earth from the waters above the earth. He creates an atmosphere and an expanse between the waters that we know as the sky to separate the waters. The term firmament refers to the visible arch of the sky. Day 3, beginning in verse 9, God gathers the waters on the earth together allowing dry land to appear. We all recognize that the earth is mostly water, right? What, three-fourths of the earth is covered by water? And I picture the earth at the beginning after God created the things in the first couple of days. It's just a big blue ball because it's covered up in water. But on day three, at God's command, you start to see the waters move and recede. You start to see mountains rising up out of the water, followed by these great land masses. And quite frankly, it must have been an incredible thing to see. But anyway, on this same day, the land, which would have been barren at first, appears, and then it begins to turn green. As grass and plants start to appear, the vegetation that is necessary for life on earth. And in these first 3 days, what we're seeing, and maybe you've taken note of this before, but in these first 3 days of creation, you're seeing God create places and spaces and habitations where in the last 3 days, He's going to place living things. You've got the habitations being created in days 1 through 3, and then in days 4 through 6, the inhabitants. Day 4, beginning in verse 14. Well, remember on day 1, God had created the heavens, both the sky as well as the space beyond the sky, where the celestial bodies now dwell. Well, on day 4 at that time, the heavens were empty, they were just there. But on this day, God created things to occupy that space. The sun, the moon, and the stars. So on day 1, He made a place for the celestial bodies to dwell. On day 4, He made the celestial bodies to dwell there. And again, this is what you're seeing in these last 3 days of creation. The creation of things to occupy and inhabit the places created in days 1 through 3. Day 5, beginning in verse 20. Well, again, remember on day 2, God had separated the waters, putting some water on the earth, some water above the earth, and then some in the atmosphere. And He created this expanse between the waters, the sky. 3 days later, He made things to dwell in these places. Sea creatures to inhabit the waters, and birds to inhabit the air. And of course, it is in these verses where we first read of actual living creatures on the earth. When God creates these creatures according to their kind, He made a distinction between different kinds of creatures. And then on day 6, beginning in verse 24, on day 3, the dry land and vegetation had appeared. Now, 3 days later, the creatures that will inhabit the land appear. And again, mention is made of living creatures according to their kinds. And of course, it is at this time that we see man make his arrival on the earth. The last act of God's creation, when He is made in the very image of God, setting Him apart from and above all the rest of creation. This is the alternative to the naturalistic concept of how the universe came into being, that life sprang from a creator, fully formed and fully developed, which is actually what the fossil record tells us. The fossil record actually says, what it says makes a lot more sense in light of what is revealed here than it does in light of what the naturalist would have us believe. That all kinds of creatures were created fully formed. There's nothing in the Genesis account to indicate any transitional creatures being made. Anything that God made with the intent of it becoming something else. The fossil record, which again is vital to the establishment of evolution as a reasonable explanation for life on earth as we know it, does not support the theory of evolution, in that it does not provide the data that evolution needs for it to provide, and it never has. Well, I know a lot of people want to ask questions like, well, what about all these skeletons, and what about all these bones of creatures that look like human bones? Well, what's the old saying? If it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. If you find bones and skulls that look like human bones, why can't they be human? Why can't we just acknowledge that they're human? Well, they're not the same shape or size as human bones. Oh, really? What's the standard shape and size of a human bone? How do we know what that would be? Have you seen the fragments that scientists oftentimes use to create an entire creature when they're recreating these earlier pieces? They'll take a 3-inch square piece of a skull and from that single little piece paint a complete picture of a prehistoric man based upon it. One anthropologist has likened this to trying to reconstruct the plot of War and Peace by using 13 random pages from the book. I was watching a DVD a while back. I picked it up at the Creation Museum when we were up there a few years ago. I was watching this DVD in which the filmmaker, and this is a guy that likes to go around talking to evolutionists and atheists and just asking them questions to challenge them. And in this particular one, he was interviewing different professors of the hard sciences at a major university out west. I've left the name of the university and the name of the professor off to protect their innocence or whatever. But anyway, he talked to a professor at one of these universities. And this professor cringed and declared, "Of course not," when asked if she accepted the possibility of intelligent design. And she went on to talk about how that she normally doesn't engage creationists in conversation because, as she said, it's not good for my blood pressure. And so the guy then asked her, "Well, why is that? Why do you have such a problem with creationists?" And basically, she said, "They just seem to lack an imagination." I love that. Let that sink in. Here's an evolutionist talking, and it sounds a lot to me like she's saying that having a good imagination is really helpful if you want to accept evolution. Well, I would agree with that statement. It does take a lot of imagination to look at the available evidence, to look at the available data, and then come up with what evolutionists posit. And when you look at a reconstruction of a creature that evolutionists say is an ancestor of man, know that a lot of imagination went into recreating that creature, just as a lot of imagination went into creating all those creatures in The Lord of the Rings. Besides that, I want to come back to this question of the standard size or shape of a human bone. People say that certain bones that have been found are not the right size for humans. Well, you remember Dr. Gertler, Josh Gertler? By the way, Miriam, he liked my post about you being baptized. He was happy to hear about that. But he's a member of the church up in Pennsylvania. Remember, we've talked about him a good bit in these series. And in his book, Unraveling Evolution, Dr. Gertler makes the point that you could take the skeletal remains of different types of people today. I'm summarizing what's on the screen. You could take the skeletal remains of different types of people today, people of different sizes from different places, and you could bury them in different places. And 1,000 years from now, they might be found, and because of the differences in them, one might assume, well, they're from different evolutionary stages. And they're not. They're just different size and shapes of people. And there's no reason to believe that this is not what has happened with the fossils that have been found that we are being told are predecessors to humans. Remember the Neanderthals? You've heard about the Neanderthals? If you're like me, you may have been called one at one time in your life. For a long time, they were considered to be the transitional creature, a missing link between ape-like creatures and men. Well, don't know if you heard the news, but based on more recent discoveries, pretty much all paleontologists agree that the Neanderthals were just human beings that lived in Europe a long time ago. They're not a missing link at all. No one believes that anymore. They did not look like cavemen, and their skulls suggest that they had as much, if not more, brain capacity than we do. Nevertheless, scientists will find certain fossil bones that they believe are ancestors of humans, and they'll give them a name like Australopithecus. That's a fancy word that means ape-like. So fossils were found, bones were found, and they looked ape-like. So we call them Australopithecus. Well, my question is, if they look ape-like, why can't they be apes? Why can't there be fossils of extinct species of apes? Well, the answer to that question is because the finders believe in evolution and want the bones they find to reveal a link between modern humans and ancestors of modern humans. Creatures that inhabit the earth today came into being in the form they are in now. Contrary to what many people will tell you, there is absolutely no evidence to the contrary. The fossil record supports this. Now, evolutionists have come up with new theories to try to account for the lack of transitional fossils, things like punctuated equilibrium, or I love this one, the hopeful monster theory. I've read a little bit about these, and they're pretty flimsy, so we won't go into them right now. If you want to ask me about them afterwards, I can show you some resources that talk about them. But despite the fact that even the fossil record supports something other than evolution, that would have to be creation, those determined to find an actual explanation are going to hold tenaciously onto this belief and continue to say, well, just wait. Eventually, we will find the evidence that we're looking for. What if you were on trial for some crime, theft or murder, and the prosecution is going to base its case against you on evidence that they might find in the future, if they can just have enough time to find it? Would a good judge or jury convict you? No. A good grand jury would never even let the case go to trial. What they might say is, well, come back when you actually have the evidence to support your case. And I do think it is not wise to deny what science actually teaches us of a factual nature. There's a lot of good things we learn from science, and we should accept those things that have been proven to be of a factual nature. But why is it not just as unwise to accept what science has failed to prove when there are other more reasonable explanations? Especially when what scientists are trying to convince us of undermines faith in the God who created us and saved us. This is where we'll stop for this evening. As I said, next week we'll wrap things up. We're going to talk a little bit about theistic evolution next week, and then we'll wrap up this series. For now, I do thank you for your attention and ask you to go ahead and get ready to lead the song that Aaron will lead us in just a moment ago. And I haven't spoken as much through the series about why I feel a series of this nature is so important, and I do. I really believe that what we've been talking about in this series is something that we need to talk about, because our faith in a creator is under such constant assault anymore. I mean, it's just assumed you go out into society that there's something wrong with you if you don't accept what society is telling us about where we came from. Well, understand, I believe what I believe about where we came from because the Bible says so. And I've got ample reason to believe the Bible. By the way, I think we'll do a study on that sometime in the future. But the fact is, even using their own data, their own methods, we can see that all this proof that there is no God, that there is no creator, is no proof at all. He is there. He is real, and he is the only reasonable explanation for the intricacy and design that we see in creation. And if he is there, then we need to recognize we've got to deal with him at some point. We've noted it before. In Hebrews chapter 4, he's described as the one with whom we have to do. And we will. We can deal with him now. We will have to deal with him later. The choice is up to us, but the wise choice is to go ahead and deal with what he has taught us. Deal with what he has told us now so that we can be better, or so that we can be prepared to meet him in the hereafter. And so anytime we get together in an assembly like this, we never close out without offering somebody here that might need the opportunity to become a Christian and prepare themselves for eternity. And if that is someone's need here tonight, we've got water in the baptistry where we can immerse you based on your faith in Jesus Christ. You'd be added to his saved body of believers known as the church. Confident of your place in heaven when this life is over. If you're a child of God that's drifted from the way, we can assist you as well. And we want to, if that is your need. If we can help you in any way, please let us. Even now as we stand and sing together.